The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. We have an exciting show where we focus primarily on international issues today. We're going to start off in just a moment talking about new U.S. sanctions against Iran. And then we're going to move over to Europe and talk a little bit about economic opportunities between Albania and the United States. And we'll come back to the United States and talk about one of the hot-button political issues of the summer, and that's the case involving Arizona's crackdown on illegal immigration and the subsequent lawsuit by the Department of Justice against that state in enforcing that law. But to start off, we're going to be joined by Dan Waltz, an attorney specializing in international sanctions law in Washington, D.C., and Richard Savoia, who is the director of USA Engage at the National Foreign Trade Council. So, Richard, Dan, welcome to the show. I hope you guys are doing well today.
Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Well, so we'll start with you, Dan. The United States Congress has just recently passed a new comprehensive bill that seems to be aimed at tougher sanctions against Iran. Tell us a little bit about the details of what's in that bill.
Well, it amends the Iran Sanctions Act, which was passed in 1996 and was really targeting non-U.S. companies. It authorized the U.S. government to impose sanctions against companies that invested $20 million or more in the Iranian petroleum or petrochemical sector. In fact, no sanctions have ever been imposed, even though those big investments have actually been made. And that led Congress to want to amend the act to force or encourage the administration to impose sanctions, but at the same time, they amended the act to include a whole grab bag, a patchwork of new things that a foreign company can do that might subject them to sanctions. The one that's probably gotten the most press is exporting or selling to Iran refined petroleum products, which means gasoline, kerosene, jet fuel, etc. The logic here is that even though Iran exports a lot of crude oil, it suffers from a lack of refining capacity, and it's dependent upon imports of refined products. Second, there is a set of sanctions available. Banks, foreign banks, that engage in transactions with Iranian banks that the U.S. government has designated as supporting terrorism or proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Basically, the U.S. government is saying to these foreign banks, either you do business with us or you do business with these Iranian banks, but you can't have it both ways.
Very interesting. Let's turn to you, Richard. I know that the commercial sector is really targeted for the first time in this bill with some tougher things. What issue is it that brought the criminal sector to bear on this process in Congress this time around?
Well, for decades, U.S. companies have been prohibited from most trade with Iran. So when these bills first appeared on the House and Senate side, not much attention was paid to them. I might add that USA Engage was formed in 1997 at the National Foreign Trade Council out of members' concern with the proliferation of these unilateral economic sanctions regimes put in place by the U.S. Congress, and USA Engage continues, to try to deal with the unintended consequences of these of such legislation. And it was really, I would call it an unintended consequence that caught people's attention, because in the original bills, there was a mandatory, additional mandatory sanction that would have prohibited the ability of U.S. companies who are not doing any business in Iran, but may have a relationship in a third country with another foreign company that is doing business in Iran. And in the original bills, the U.S. company's business would have been prohibited. That was ameliorated in conference.
Let me come back to you, Dan, and talk me through some of the policy implications of this bill passing, and what does it mean for impacted companies going forward?
Well, what's striking about this bill is it doesn't target U.S. companies. It really targets non-U.S. companies, and this is the kind of aggressive assertion of U.S. power that in the past has triggered opposition. In the 1980s, the U.S. tried to stop foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies from participating in the construction of the Soviet gas pipeline into Europe. That sparked a strong backlash, and the U.S. had to back down. In the 90s, you had Helms-Burton, which authorized lawsuits against non-U.S. companies trafficking in certain Cuban property, and you had the original Iran Sanctions Act. That also sparked a strong backlash, and the U.S. had eventually to negotiate an agreement with the European Union. One thing I find striking here is that we don't see that strong backlash, or at least we haven't seen it yet. Countries such as China and India have issued statements opposing the law, but there seems to be more unanimity in the part of the international community given the widespread concerns about Iran generally. But I think the other interesting thing is, as I mentioned, no sanctions were ever imposed under the original Iran Sanctions Act. Now you've got Congress telling the administration, we want you to get serious. And you've also got a whole variety of potential targets that are much smaller than the oil companies making massive investments in the Iranian petroleum industry. So I think we may now see for the first time sanctions imposed against non-U.S. companies under the amended act. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of response that engenders.
I'm sure that will spark some international concern if the first companies sanctioned are non-U.S. companies. Richard, let me come back to you. Talk to me a little bit about Dan's theory here that perhaps there's more international cooperation against Iran. Has there been a change in the environment and concern about their development of weapons of mass destruction that has people cooperating where in the past they've chosen not to? Or are there other reasons that these countries aren't attacking the U.S. for passing this law?
Well, I think it's the former. There is no doubt that it is much in the geopolitical situation that Iran's presumed advance towards nuclear weapon capability, coupled with their present capability in terms of missile capacity, has caught everyone's attention. So, for instance, you did have passage, and the Obama administration worked diligently for passage of a fourth round of UN sanctions shortly before this conference report was finished on the legislation we've been talking about. The EU has a sanctions regime in process. The EU ministers are meeting on July 26th. To spell out in some more detail what the EU sanctions will look like, based again on the predicate of the UN sanctions, as this U.S. legislation has been talked about as being based on. That was Senator Kerry's constant assertion throughout the conference that a multilateral regime of sanctions with individuals or groups of countries going further is to be the goal, and that's where we seem to be now. On the other side of that coin are the always unintended consequences to an ever more complicated global supply chain. And who knows how that will work out. I give you one example that we're concerned about in terms of the financial sanctions that we've talked about, and that's there is in the legislation, and there has always been, a humanitarian exception for goods and services in food and medical products and flight safety.
It sounds like it could be a pretty big exception.
Well, it's always been modest, but you know, and you have to be, and in order for U.S. Entities to trade in those in that humanitarian trade, you have to receive a license from the Office of Foreign Asset Control from the U.S. Treasury, which is administered by the same Undersecretary Stuart Levy that's led the financial sanctions. All of that said. And that has been reaffirmed in the statute, it remains to be seen whether any of those transactions going forward will be able to be financed. I mean, if international banks are simply going to say, well, we can either do business in the U.S. or do business with Iran, and the simple way to answer that question is simply to do no business with Iran, what happens to that humanitarian trade, for example?
Interesting. Well, I've got about a minute or so left, Dan. Talk to me about the politics here domestically of who's involved and what failure or success would mean politically.
Well, it's pretty obvious that no one in Congress was going to stand up and defend Iran. That's why the bill passed with no opposition in the Senate, 99-0, and an overwhelming majority in the House. So in that sense, politically, it was a no-brainer. There were concerns that we'd antagonize our allies, but really the momentum in favor of passing the bill was overwhelming. The other point I would make to complement what Richard said, even though no sanctions were ever imposed under the old or original act, what we're seeing in the market already is a change in behavior because of the fear that sanctions will now be imposed under these amendments. I've read reports that Iranian aircraft are being denied fuel before they return to Iran, presumably because the fuel-selling company fears it could be charged with exporting refined product to Iran and thus expose itself to sanctions.
Makes it hard to get home.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've not talked about the, in terms of unintended consequences, whether, in fact, sanctioning the Islamic Republic will what kind of effects it will have within the country. I too have seen reports of legitimate merchants inside and outside Iran being squeezed to the benefit of the very people we're trying to target, the so-called rogue regime.
Well, we'll have to save that discussion for another time. We've been joined by Richard Savoia and Dan Waltz. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about economic development in Albania.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202- 457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Finish.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. Well, we're continuing our irregular series of reviewing the economic opportunities in a range of countries for American businesses thinking of expanding abroad. And today we're going to focus on Albania. And joining us to discuss that is one of the leading lights in American foreign policy work, former Ambassador Frank Wisner. Ambassador Wisner has spent the better part of four decades working on behalf of the United States in a variety of diplomatic roles. He served as the ambassador to for the United States to four different countries in the Middle East and Africa. He was also the Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs from 1982 to 1986, and somebody that we look to from time to time on the show to educate us. Today he's going to educate us about Albania. So welcome, Ambassador. How are you today?
Thank you very much. Pleased to be with you.
Terrific. Well, tell us a little bit. Tell us a little bit about who Albania is in 2010 and why it's of strategic interest to the United States to improve our relationship with that country.
Right. Well, I'm pleased to do so. Albania is a small country on the Adriatic, but it is a country of significance. The United States attaches considerable importance to the Balkans. We were involved in a war earlier this decade over Kosovo, last decade over Kosovo. A majority of its population is Albanian. Albania came out from a long period of communist rule, just over a decade ago, and it has made extraordinary strides, modernizing its economy, beginning its experience with democratic practice, and developing a very deep friendship with the United States. The Albanians have soldiers in Afghanistan. They've taken former prisoners in Guantanamo as part of doing favors for the United States. Through the last several administrations, they've been very, very keen to strengthen and deepen ties that go right back to the time of Woodrow Wilson, to whom the Albanians credit with preserving their independence when others might have divided them up after World War I.
So many of the countries that have escaped the shadows of communism have had a very difficult transition to democracy, and that obviously roils economic conditions in those countries. Tell us a little bit about Albania's transition and how that has gone and how that impacts the economic environment there.
Perhaps no nation in Eastern Europe or the Balkans had a harsher period of rule under the communists than did Albania. The dictator Enver Hoxha ruled the country with an absolute iron hand and sealed it off from the world for many, many decades. So when Albania came out from under a rock, it was not only fundamentally a very distant and backward nation, but it had been isolated by this period of communist rule. And it had its troubled beginnings. governments found it hard to settle down and integrate themselves with the world. There was an economic catastrophe around a huge Ponzi scheme. Albania had its troubles. Nonetheless, it is broken down today, or settled down, into basically a sort of two-party system. The ruling party now has a coalition majority, not a big one. Elections were held recently. They were certified by the OSCE, the Organization for the Political Future of Eastern Europe in Vienna, and welcomed by the United States. We have a very good relationship with the country, politically working with them on strengthening governance. One of the things that Americans will find really quite remarkable for a small country, but starting from so far back, is virtually all the work of government is now e-government. You can sit down with your computer and pay your taxes and register your car and get your property license. All of these things now are possible in Albania online. So the Albanians are trying to stomp out corruption and move their country ahead into the first rank of modern European nations.
So, not having had the opportunity to visit there, tell me a little bit about the big industries there and the opportunities that you see for partnerships with Americans interested in expanding abroad.
Well, as I say, it's a small country, but it's beautifully situated, lovely great mountains coming down to the edge of the Adriatic, a wonderful coastline, superb beaches. Tourism development is just now beginning. The whole southern coast of the country is virtually without tourism infrastructure, and tourism over Europe is pretty well built out all along the Mediterranean. Albania is one of the last places. I think in terms of big-ticket items, the Albanians are investing heavily in infrastructure. They've just finished, with Bechtel at their side, a major road through the mountains and into the central Balkans, into Kosovo. They are planning other significant highway developments. They're going to be expanding their electrical power generation networks. They are doing hydropower in addition to conventional fuel sources of power. Their telecom industry is expanding. They will be expanding in the field of petroleum refining. In other words, the big bones of infrastructure. As to industrial development, I think the prospects, bluntly, are not overwhelming, but they're attractive, for Albania is on a road to becoming a member of the European Union. Its wage rates are much lower than anywhere else in Europe. A company that is there will get attractive benefits in terms of land offered to it by government, tax breaks and benefits, one-stop shopping registration, and get itself in and start looking at the European market. The level of literacy is very high in the country. Skills are reasonably good, but developing rapidly. There are chances of positioning yourself for further work into the European Union as Albania over the next years completes the criteria that will produce European entry.
And when question, which I won't really ask you to answer, is I'm not sure I'd want to be in the European Union given their situation right now. Maybe they might be better off going it on their own, as tough as the EU is having things. But bring Albania here to the United States.
I'd pause you for a second and remember the biggest marketplace in the world today is the European Union, even
they got to get in
North America.
Well, let me ask you this. Obviously, after the EU, the United States is probably second on that list of biggest marketplaces. What are the Albanians looking for when they come to Washington and fostering a better relationship with the United States, or in building better relationship with American consumers and businesses?
Well, with the United States, the Albanians believe we have been their strongest well-wisher and are the party most likely to maintain peace and stability in the Balkans. With a history of wars and ethnic antagonism in the region, the struggle for Kosovo's independence, There's still unresolved issues. Macedonia is still settling down. Your former Yugoslavia is broken up. It's been a period of real tough transition, and the Albanians look to the United States to be a stabilizer. Therefore, they got themselves as a candidate and have entered into NATO, very important relationship, but they really look to Washington to be that key and important stabilizer. We provided some modest economic assistance. That should continue. But I think the Albanians are now moving beyond the sort of normal aid-donor relationship and into wanting to enter the private field. They'd love one day to have a free trade agreement with the United States. But I think there's also scope in the short run for issues like a investment agreement would make a great deal of sense as a short-term endeavor. In a number of areas, we cooperate with them. I mentioned the fact Albanian soldiers serve in Afghanistan. They're giving us a hand with moving prisoners out of Guantanamo. These are just visible symbols of political level cooperation. Albanians will want very much to come close as they can to American foreign policy goals. They're a true friend right now, and it's nice to have friends in this world.
Well, you're right. Anytime you say that they took detainees from Gitmo and they have troops on the ground fighting alongside the United States in Afghanistan and the war on terror, I think those are probably two pretty good pieces of evidence that they are a true friend of the United States and not somebody that just talks about working with us but is actually putting that into practice. I think we are have time for maybe a couple more closing thoughts, Ambassador. Anything else we need to know about Albania that we haven't already hit?
Well, I am pleased also to underscore there's a pretty large Albanian-American population in this country. And the level of English, the knowledge of this country is really deep and widespread. Americans are warmly received in Albania. It's not just a government attitude. It's particularly true the man on the street who has a cousin in New York or in Detroit. Americans who visit the country and see its many beautiful spots, its ancient fortresses, its beautiful coastline, will find themselves throughout surrounded with well-wishers and good friends, and I encourage those who'd like to see something they've not seen before in Europe and have access to by road systems other parts of Europe, take a look at it. You won't find anything prettier. It's an extension of the famous Dalmatian coast and just as beautiful.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. We've been joined by Ambassador Frank Wisner talking about the merits of closer relationships between Albania and the United States. We'll be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology Strategy and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, we're keeping with our theme of talking about international issues today. We're going to talk a little bit about the big immigration controversy and the federal government's decision to sue the state of Arizona over implementation of their immigration law. Joining us, we have two great guests today that talk about that issue. Kristen Wells, who's a former staffer on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She should be joining us here in just a moment. And also Professor Carl Mannheim from the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, who is interrupting his vacation in the Pacific Northwest to phone in and chat with us today. So, Professor, welcome, and I hope we haven't taken you away from the rivers and streams for too long today.
My pleasure.
Well, let's talk a little bit. This is obviously a very controversial law. It's gotten a great deal of attention in the last 3 months, and talk a little bit about the constitutionality and what's going on. I know that you've said the federal government does have, of course, the federal government has the power to regulate immigration, and the states only can sort of fill in the gaps on an issue like this. But tell me where you think the Constitution lies in this at the core of this dispute.
Well, to understand it, we have to go back to this long simmering dispute between states' rights and national power. An issue that was really the founding basis for our Constitution, that wrenched the country apart in the mid-19th century, the Civil War, which I call the Great Federalism War, the war over states' rights. And, of course, it is still our most persistent and challenging constitutional issue. So the question is to, as between the state and the national government, which has the power over immigration? That question has long been settled. It turns out states have no power over immigration whatsoever. They have no power over foreign affairs whatsoever. And so for a state to pass an immigration law is simply an exercise in futility because it doesn't have power to do that in the first place. That power resides exclusively with the federal government. So no matter whether one agrees with the policy statements in the law or not, it is something that only the federal government can act and not an individual state.
And you think this is really a state immigration law, or is it closer to something to do with the police power that a state has?
Well, that's exactly the right question. So we can start with the fundamentals. If it is a pretty much standard or routine police power enactment, then that would ordinarily be within the power of the state, the reserve powers of the states, and they would be valid unless and until preempted by supreme federal law. But if it is an immigration law, then it doesn't matter what Congress has done. The states simply don't have the power there. So the first question to answer is whether this is an immigration law or a more routine police power enactment. And there are parts of it that look a lot like a police power enactment, but there are also parts of it that look unmistakably like an immigration law. Especially the when you enter the law, when you take a look at the preamble, you see that the purpose of the law is to discourage and deter the unlawful entry and presence of aliens in the United States. That is simply not a purpose that the state of Arizona or any other state may pursue. It does not have the power to do that. So maybe this is simply an exercise of poor drafting on the part of the legislature in Arizona, but they have admitted that they are and have enacted an immigration law, and that is really all you need, and that's pretty much what the complaint filed by the Department of Justice says.
Well, let me bring Kristen Wells in. Kristen's somebody who had a legal counsel position with the House of Representatives on a couple committees of great relevance here. And Kristen, I want to ask you, the NAACP actually just wrapped up their annual convention, I believe, this week, and spent some time talking about this Arizona law, calling it unconstitutional, worried about racial profiling. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of grassroots groups, that what sort of voice they have in the process of a legal fight like this? Because it's obviously partly a political fight, right? Kristen, you there with us? No, okay. I thought we had her, and I guess we do not have her yet. So let me come back to you, Professor. I apologize.
No problem. I'd be happy to answer that question, by the way.
Sure, please, go ahead.
That's actually a very interesting question, because this Arizona law, like many laws, has more than simply legal impact, and that is it makes a political statement. And to the extent that it makes a political statement, it's essentially criticizing the federal government for failure to enforce federal immigration law. That has already had an impact and may have already succeeded. It's gotten the attention of the Obama administration and Congress. They are now redoubling their efforts at trying to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And so you might credit the Arizona law with having made a very successful political statement, and certainly has aroused the passions of a lot of folks around the country. But as a law, it will not survive the court challenges that lie ahead.
So you mentioned sort of the war between the states and all that good stuff, and this is obviously an issue that brings a great deal of passion. I think you uttered the phrase states' rights. So tell me, is this somewhat of a replay of some of the classic states' rights battles of the past?
Oh, absolutely. That has been the most persistent and deep-rooted constitutional struggle in our 230-year history, and that is the relative standing of the state legislatures and the national legislature, our Congress, over certain powers. We say that the states are somewhat quasi or demi-sovereign in the United States, and the Tenth Amendment to the Constitution reinforces that powers that the federal government does not have reside with the states. But this is certainly a power that the federal government does have, and it's a power that the states never exercised. Let me just step back one moment and talk about where immigration fits.
Well, let me jump in. Kristen, are you with us now?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Good. All right.
Okay, great.
Listen, I do want to get you involved here. But we were asking a little bit about sort of the political dynamics, and I know you have some good insights in why the Attorney General filed a suit at this time and sort of what the politics of all this is. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, as Professor Manheim said, it's patently an unconstitutional law. The law is very clear on this. I think there's a huge amount of politics behind this on both sides. A number of other states have come out in support of the Arizona law, and I think one of the reasons the suit was filed is to send a very clear message to the states that we have over 200 years of legal history on this. There is no doubt that the federal government, through the powers vested in the Constitution to Congress, have the right to determine immigration policy, and that, as the Attorney General said, a patchwork system is not only going to work, it's not going to be acceptable. And it would really, if we think that this is contentious, imagine how it would tear at the fabric of American society to have every state having a different immigration law. If the Constitution doesn't matter, then one state can say, well, we're not allowing any Asians into our state, and another state can say...
As California did in the late 19th century.
Right, of course. I mean, we've had race and nationality have long been huge parts of our immigration system. It's only in recent decades that much of that has been tersed out so that we have a race and nationality neutral system.
Let me push back just a little. So you both say this is clearly unconstitutional. All the polling data seems to indicate that the American public is strongly in favor of this bill. So you're saying a majority of the United States just has it wrong?
Well, they may not have read the parts of the Constitution that give Congress the power to do this, to handle immigration. They may not understand the Immigration and Nationality Act, which I assure you many immigration lawyers spend decades trying to understand. And in addition, I think, really the American citizens are rightfully voicing their upset and concern through these polls and through their public comments. But unfortunately, a number of people who raise those concerns are the same people who call Congress and say, don't pass that measure. Don't pass comprehensive immigration reform when it comes up in the Judiciary Committee. Don't bring it to the floor. And so on the one hand, there's an argument of, the federal government, really Congress here, is not doing its job by legislating on this matter. And on the other hand, the citizens and the members of Congress who prevent that from happening are the same people that are now saying, it's okay for Arizona to do this because the federal government hasn't done it, and then every time the federal government tries to do it, we try to stop them. So, there's a lot of politics here. This issue I worked on for 5 years on the Judiciary Committee and several more years on the Committee on Foreign Affairs, and every election cycle, immigration becomes a very hot issue. It is a very polarizing issue. It is about getting votes from either the Latino community or the more right-wing conservative community. There's a lot at play here, and I saw in an article that Governor Brewer's was looking like the underdog in her race, and now her two competitors have dropped out of the primary, so it has made a big difference for her to have signed this law. And I think that the Obama administration is not only trying to make a clear point to the states, but they are also trying to make a clear political point that they are serious about passing comprehensive immigration reform, and that the way to do it is not by having states do something piecemeal, but to stop this kind of behavior and transition that into the power to really pass something legislatively through the House and Senate.
We're getting into the meat of the matter. We got to hit a commercial break, but we're going to bring back the professor and Kristen to and wrap up our hour here right after we come back with a message.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at
at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, we are continuing our discussion of the controversial Arizona crackdown on illegal immigration and the Department of Justice's subsequent decision to sue to try and have that law declared unconstitutional before it is actually enforced later this month. We're joined by Professor Carl Mannheim from Loyola Law School and Kristen Wells, the former Deputy Chief Counsel of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And Kristen, I'm going to come back to you and ask, clearly the DOJ lawsuit is going to be on the fast track to the Supreme Court. And tell me a little bit about a Supreme Court that seems to break 5-4 on almost every significant issue. How you see them cobbling together the ability to, frankly, convince Justice Kennedy to join four more moderate or liberal justices to vote to declare this law unconstitutional?
That's an interesting question. Honestly, I'm not sure that the Supreme Court will hear this case. I'd be interested in hearing Professor Mannheim's view on that. I think that there is so much settled law on this that they might not provide certiorari for review, and they might deny it if it comes to them. I would be very surprised if it made it through the Court of Appeals without being denied. But of course, the state may file back and try to raise it to the Supreme Court.
Professor, what do you think? Is the Supreme Court actually going to turn down this case?
I completely agree with Kristen's assessment. First of all, we have to look back in our history over these states' rights issues. During the late 19th and early 20th century, the Supreme Court was as conservative as it is now and was striking down all sorts of federal laws in the name of states' rights and so forth. But even during that very pro-state 50-year period, the Supreme Court was quite clear and adamant that when it came to the foreign relations of the United States, the states had zero power. They had dip, and that it was all in the federal government. So the fact that, as you correctly note, that a lot of these important constitutional cases break by four grounds, I just don't see very many votes here, maybe one at the most, quite frankly, Justice Thomas, who would vote to uphold the Arizona law. So,
That's assuming, though, that the lower courts have ruled in favor of the DOJ.
Exactly. So, in other words, if the district court in Arizona and the Ninth Circuit on appeal strike down the Arizona law, then I just don't see the Supreme Court granting certiorari. On the other hand, if the Ninth Circuit were to uphold the Arizona law, I think Supreme Court reversal would be predicted.
Interesting. I might have a slightly different opinion about that, but I think that's
you have to put this in the context of foreign relations generally. A month ago, the president of Mexico addressed a joint session of Congress, complaining about the Arizona law. You really don't want to have a situation where individual states can essentially dictate the foreign policy of the United States. Immigration is an essential ingredient.
Many of the others would say that our laws are, Arizona's law is actually softer than Mexico's own law in dealing with illegal immigrants.
Well, it may be, but that's quite beside the point. You don't want to have the nation as a whole being committed to deal with an individual state's own foreign policy. States don't have the power to engage in foreign policy for the very reason that it implicates the national security concerns and the diplomatic concerns of the country as a whole. Now, let me raise a very controversial historical point that we alluded to during the break, and that is that California, which has had its own history of immigration laws. Once was very punitive towards Asians and prohibited Asians, for instance, from owning land in California. And, of course, there's the whole history of World War II where we interned American citizens of Japanese ancestry. Some historians have claimed that California's animosity towards Asia and Japan in particular was one of the contributing factors for Japan's entry into World War II. So you just don't want to have a repeat of that situation where individual states go off the deep end and somehow damage the diplomatic efforts of the country. So if Arizona, for instance, wanted to develop a foreign policy towards Iran or Albania, which was the topic of your first segment today, we certainly wouldn't accept that. And the fact that this deals with an issue of great emotional concern for a lot of Americans just simply doesn't change that calculus.
Let me just also add that, you know, when you think about our borders, we probably have, I don't know the exact number, at least 10 states on our northern and southern border. We have a 7,000-mile border with Canada, something like a 3,000 or 4,000-mile border with Mexico. I mean, we can't have every state having different policies on border security. And so these issues must be federal, and they need to be worked out and negotiated in a balance with all of the other issues.
Well, I think, though, let me jump in here. I think the reason that the northern border states don't have the problem that Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Texas have right now, and so the question is, if we follow the logic here that you all are laying out, that the Supreme Court or lower court will invalidate this law, then what does that mean for states that want to do something to protect their borders from undocumented workers coming across, illegal immigration continuing to flow, and the stream of negatives they see from that, from increases in crime to demand for public services for which taxpayers are held accountable?
Well, let's assume that all those factors are true for the sake of this discussion. The way our federal system works is that the Congress of the United States is made up of representatives from the individual states. You know, each state has its two senators in the Senate, and they all have members of the House of Representatives. The way an individual state influences the foreign policy of the United States is through their representatives in Congress. And so what Arizona and New Mexico and Texas and so forth ought to do, if they find that their border enforcement is inadequate, is to make the necessary moves in Congress. That is the appropriate way for them to work within the law.
And I would add that, you know, local politicians can help their own citizens understand that process and to say, if you don't like the way things are happening in your neighborhood on this issue, write your congressman, write your senator, tell them what kinds of changes are needed in our national immigration policy, and support an immigration bill that's going to do that. You have to recognize that there's going to have to be trade-offs. There are a lot of different kinds of communities in the United States. There are thousands and thousands of people in this country who have been waiting decades to have their family members join them from other countries around the world. So family reunification is a big unsolved problem in our immigration system. And when it comes right down to it, there are, you know, of course, now that we're in a recession, this is a little bit less so, but over the last decade, the unemployment rate in the United States has been hovering in the 4 to 5% range. And the truth of the matter has been that there really have been jobs here for low-skilled workers who are willing to do jobs where they, unfortunately, don't get benefits, don't get great living conditions, or even sometimes the best wages that they ought to get. But those are jobs that most Americans will not move across the country to do. And the reason people come in illegally is because the jobs are here, the jobs are drawing them, but there's no legal way for them to enter. And so the reason that there's been so much of a call for comprehensive reform is that while, yes, we need to strengthen and tighten the border so that we know who's coming through and so that we can monitor that and make sure that people enter in a safe and legal manner, at the same time, we have to provide a legal opportunity for people to come in and work temporarily in our agricultural fields in the West and in the South, or work more long-term in hospitality and in other industries which have dire needs for this labor source. And I think a lot of Americans think that that's a bad thing, but we don't realize that in countries where there is not immigration, populations, or substantial immigration, populations are aging and aging, and they are finding their social systems squeezed as fewer and fewer younger people have to support and provide for a rapidly increasing senior citizenry.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to be back next week with another great episode of Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.